Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is the one and only Scarycast. I'm Dr. John Stamey. We've got a bang-up show for you tonight. Great guest, great panelists, and we're going to get right to the show. First of all, our co-host from the Midlands of South Carolina, the Surgeon General of Scarycast, the one and only Dr. Trey Dunaway. How are you doing, Trey?
Good day today, John. Doing fine.
Well, great. Well, we're glad to have you here. And from Pasadena, California, our former man in Hollywood, now he's our man in California, the one and only Devin Tate. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. I got to spend all day yesterday out on a boat on Lake Folsom. So anytime you get to be out on a boat, I think it's a good day.
You know, I think you're 100% right. Well, glad to have you here. And from Houston, Texas, Kyler Smith, how are you doing tonight?
Well rested and excited to see what we got to talk about. I'm almost shaking already. I've been looking at it before we even started.
Yeah, we've got an explosive topic. And explosive is the name of our guest, the one from Roswell, New Mexico, the one and only John LeMay. How are you doing tonight, John?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's always good to be on Scarycast. So
we are glad to have you here. We got a great topic tonight, and the topic is the Bladenboro Monster, new research about the Bladenboro Monster that John LeMay has uncovered, thing or two that I have uncovered about Bladen County, and shapeshifters. So we've got some really interesting stuff to talk about. I'd say about 80% of it's brand new that has come to light probably in the last month. And, you know, that goes to show that when you're doing research, it's amazing what can come up. It is. So without any further ado, we will get going. John called me a couple of days ago and said, John, I have found some interesting stuff about the Bladenboro Monster. You remember you told me about it? And I said, you know, I do remember that. We talked briefly about it and what it was, and I will kind of briefly recap it for everybody. There was a four-legged crazy monster that during the early 50s terrorized the small town of Bladenboro, North Carolina. That is pretty much right across from the state line of North and South Carolina. Basically, if you want the gory details, you take Highway 701 up to Highway 410, and you catch that right outside of Tabor City, North Carolina. You drive about 14 miles, and you are in beautiful, sunny Chadburn, which the only thing that goes on there is the Strawberry Festival, if I can tell you that. There's not a lot going on in Chadburn. And then if you take Highway 242 out of Chadburn, you reach the tiny town of Bladenboro. Most all the town is on the main street. There are a few houses off Main Street. It's a town of probably about 3,000 people. And what's their claim to fame is the Bladenboro Beast Festival, which is the third weekend in October. And I'm going to be going there this year because I'm going to be going up trying to do some reconnaissance and on-the-ground research, because I have this buddy named John LeMay. He was telling me about some new research about the Bladenboro Monster, and he kind of said, well, you know, John, you're over there. Would you be interested in helping me work on a book about the Bladenboro Monster and shapeshifters? I said, without a doubt, John, that would be the most exciting thing that I can imagine. So not only that weekend did I finish Look Up in the Sky version 3.0, which is really an interesting book. It's newly edited, got brand new stories about the Sydney Monsters. It's got stories about Dogman and some other new stories. Oh, it has a new version of the story about the Blue People up in Gate City, Virginia. It has some interesting illustrations of the Dogman and the Gate City Blue People. And those are on the back cover. So a lot of interesting things and a lot of time went into preparing that third edition of Look Up in the Sky, and I'm very proud of it. Just glad that we made it, and we premiered that at the Jacksonville Mini-Con this past weekend, about sold out of it. It was very popular. People were excited to see it. In fact, two people bought new copies. They had actually edition 2.0, and they were glad to get edition 3.0, along with yours truly's signature, of course, but just teasing. It was great. It was a lot of fun. And so I'm there talking to people. You know, people are coming by my table, and there's this fellow that's a filmmaker, and he's got a lot of paranormal stories. He came by with two of his kids. One was, I think, 16, and the other one was 19, and they were really nice people. He's got a video production business there in Jacksonville. And I said, so what do you know about Bladen County and the Bladenboro Monster and some interesting things about it? He said, I know the most interesting thing you've heard about Bladen County. I told this to John LeMay earlier, and he said, wow, that's something that might really tie into what we're talking about. It seems as though there's a it's about a 10-mile square lake called White Lake. About 15,000 years ago, a meteorite split in the atmosphere, and a large chunk of it went down into that area, and it dug out an almost perfectly circular basin, which soon filled up from some artesian springs underground. Now, we don't know how deep those artesian springs go. I did some research about it, and nobody's really done it. There's some research that's been done by some folks at my alma mater, North Carolina State University, and at our rival University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So I'm going to have a chance to interview those two scientists and find out exactly what they know. But there are apparently some odd paranormal things and odd vibes that go on at White Lake. There's some skiing, and it's really a nice area for families in the summertime. They have about 20,000 visitors a year. But my new buddy up there, my filmmaker buddy, said, there's some strangeness up there. I said, well, can we go up there and film a little thing, and let's see what we can come up with? He said, absolutely. So I'm supposed to talk with him later this week about going to Bladen County and going to White Lake, which is also a small town, and seeing what we can find about that lake and about the strangeness that goes on. There's a lot of strangeness in that entire area of North Carolina. That is the home of Lake Waccamaw. Now, if you go to the Whiteville Chamber of Commerce, they'll tell you there are no known ghost stories. Well, all you have to do is go to the Lake Waccamaw Chamber of Commerce, and there are five books on the subject of ghosts or in and around Lake Waccamaw. It is terrifically haunted. It's creepy. I mean, it just is. And it has the distinction of having every type of marine plant in North Carolina indigenous to Lake Waccamaw, which I think is very interesting. And, of course, they liked me because I'm into the paranormal, and I think they want to sell some of my books up there, so I got to go back and see them and make friends again. I was up there about 6 months ago and had a grand time at the Chamber of Commerce, so don't miss that one if you're ever up there in the area. And I can't wait to make friends at the White Lake Chamber of Commerce. That's going to be a lot of fun, and find out some of the mysteries that are involved up there. So that's something that John and I can add to our little book about Bladen County, the Bladenboro Monster, and just the whole thing up there. It's a really, really cool area, steeped in mystery, steeped in the paranormal. So John, I think we've got a great thing to look forward to up there in Bladen County. How does that sound?
Well, as usual, Dr. John's being too nice. It was actually his idea to do the book on the Bladenboro Monster, and I just kind of asked him if I could join into it, because you mentioned that to me probably almost half a year ago by now. Time goes so fast. You and I were talking about those shape-shifting vampire witches from Mexico, the Telapuches, because they were from the mid-1950s, right? And we were both just saying, well, that's an interesting correlation about these blood-sucking shapeshifters. You know, both happened kind of around the same time, just in different portions of you know, the world, and, you know, down in Mexico in the case of the vampire witches, and then the Blattenboro Beast is North Carolina, or was it South Carolina? I already forgot. North or South?
It's North Carolina, Blattenboro, North Carolina.
Okay. Yeah, so in the case of the Blattenboro Monster, I just started researching it for fun because it interested John, and I found all these newspaper articles about it. It was really a sensation for its time back in January of 1954. The newspapers just went nuts for it, and you can tell why, because, you know, it wasn't horribly uncommon back in those days to have, like, mysterious predators that would come and kill livestock, and they would never, you know, quite be able to identify it. But what made this thing so strange was, like John said, its appearance would kind of change from witness to witness. And the other weird thing it did was it sucked the blood from its kills. So it was kind of like a vampire. And the press even called it a vampire, which was pretty unusual. So that's what made the Blattenboro Beast just so unique, and why it wasn't just another animal on the loose killing livestock and stuff like that. Cryptozoology does have a subset devoted to something that they call ABCs, in that case meaning alien big cats, and not alien as in extraterrestrial, but they just mean alien in terms of it's a large feline predatory cat outside of its normal environment, kind of like we have phantom panther sightings across the United States or phantom lions just out in the wild where they shouldn't be. There's quite a few of those, but again, the Blattenboro Beast is totally different from that just because of how unique its behavior was.
Well, it was, and I think the first sighting was on New Year's Day, and there was a farmer, and he heard a scuffle outside on his, now this is from memory, but he heard a scuffle outside on his porch, and he looked out, and there was his favorite dog, his favorite hunting dog, basically being torn up by this monster. And he did not want to go outside because he was a bit fearful of it. So he watched the Blattenboro Monster basically tear up his favorite hunting dog. And so when the Blattenboro Monster ate part of the dog and left, he went out. He was very sad, and he put the carcass of the dog on the ground where he was going to bury it the next day. So later that day, his other dog was on the porch and also got attacked and killed by the Blattenboro Beast. I guess we'll call it the Blattenboro Beast, John, because that's the name of the festival. Excuse me. So, anyway, both of his dogs got killed that day, and he went to, I believe, the newspaper of record at that time and still is the Lumberton, North Carolina newspaper, or the Robson Herald. Right, that's the newspaper of record. And he went there, and he told them the story. And they really got behind it. Now they did.
Yeah. So I was looking up the date. You're basically right. It was December 29th of 53, and that's exactly like you said it was, except for the date. And that was, I think, in a town kind of near Blattenboro, and it didn't come to Blattenboro itself until like early January, and then like the big story that broke on January 5th was it was headlined "Vampire Charges Woman," and I've got it here in front of me. The story goes: a large marauding cat that has killed and sucked the blood of at least seven dogs charged a woman here tonight, but turned and fled back into a swamp when she screamed and her husband rushed onto the scene. Police Chief Roy Fors said the animal charged into the yard of Mrs. C.E. Kinlaw when she went out onto her front porch to investigate whimpering dogs in the street. After the incident occurred, the armed posse that went out tonight to track down and kill the vampire swelled to some 500 people and scores of dogs. Mrs. Kinlaw, who lives in the Mill Village near Blattenboro Mills on Highway 211, 1 mile west of here, said she heard the dogs whimpering early tonight and went to investigate. Near the dogs, she said, was what looked like to her a, quote, big mountain lion, unquote. It raced from three doors down the dirt street in front of her house to a few feet from her porch, then turned back when she screamed and her husband rushed out of the house. A neighbor also came to her aid. Chief Fors said the tracks in the dirt road in front of her home were, quote, bigger than a silver dollar, end quote. And let's see, the article concludes by saying a search party from Wilmington, which tracked the animal last night as it moved in a three-mile circle along the edges of swampy areas, found tracks which revealed claws. So that was the first big article that really started to get people excited.
And that was from the Robsonian newspaper, right?
Yeah, Robsonian.
Right, that's you know, I know it looks like Robsonian, but it's Robsonian.
Okay.
That's the pronunciation up there. Or as I was told by Reverend Hector Murray, he's a favorite at local Comic Cons. He's got a series of books called Faith and Fandom, Finding God at Comic Cons. It's a great series of books. He's on book 13. He said, if you don't call it Robson County or if you don't call it Robsonian, they know you're from out of town. So we'll make sure we get that one right. Yeah. And hopefully, to publicize this book, we can get Hector and we can also get the police chief from Tabor City, Chief Dulles, who's a very close friend of mine, who has been instrumental in the research for the Sydney Monsters. And he, I'm sure he will help me get access to whatever police records are available for the Bladenborough monster, or Bladenborough beast. So it's really good to have friends in law enforcement up there, especially those that like the paranormal. They've been a lot of help on the Sydney Monsters, and most of the article in the book Look Up in the Sky version 3.0 could never have been written without Chief Dulles. I mean, it was just without him and without, of course, the Tabor City Tribune Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper. And we've got a lot of resources. We've got the Robsonian, we've got the Whiteville News, which is just southwest of Bladenborough, and we've got the Tabor City News or the Tabor City Tribune. So we've got three newspapers that I can scour. So, you know, John, there are really a lot of resources that we will have to put in this book, and I think it's exciting that we will, plus some research I've been doing on shapeshifters. So now, John, I'd like for you to go ahead and tell everybody the exciting thing that you found, the article that you said kind of put it all in perspective. It was a brand new article that you found. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, so I think I'll tell the story kind of chronologically so that way the audience can enjoy it, because it reminds me a lot of the movie Jaws, because, you know, you've got the police chief and you've got the mayor, and then you've got like a killing of an animal that they think is the killer and it turns out not to be. That's about how the Bladenborough story goes. So, again, for the next several nights, they just did tons and tons of articles on what they kept calling the vampire, and I'm kind of just scrolling through them here. Now, to tie into what you were saying about shapeshifters, something I thought was interesting is one of those articles said that to them, the monster sounded like a woman in distress, like it sounded like a woman shrieking or in distress. And that's a trait that a lot of real shapeshifters or skinwalkers allegedly have, is they will do these vocalizations of like an infant crying or a woman in distress that will attract people to come to the rescue, and then that they'll kill the person. So that's kind of one of the first clues that maybe, just maybe, the Bladenborough beast could have been a shapeshifter and not just some random predator. But the town was really freaked out about it. This website, North Carolina Ghosts, they interviewed an old-timer named Ev Butler, who was a young man when all of this took place in the 1950s. And he said, quote, "Nighttime was the feared time around these parts. As the sun set, the entire community on the west side of town went indoors and didn't come out unless necessary." So basically, you know, it was the town that dreaded sundown. They were, you know, really worried about where this thing would strike next. G4 is even, you know, was kind of advising parents, you know, they should keep an extra close eye on their kids and not let them out after dark. And apparently that was really true. It wasn't just overblown media hype. So I'm just looking through the dates here. I see one where they called it the breeder beast of Bladenboro. I guess that was before they just settled on beast of Bladenboro. But I'm trying to get to this part where they kill this this mountain lion, and they think that the mountain lion is the Bladenboro beast, and it's not. But as this mania continues, they keep having these hunting parties almost every night, and the town government starts to worry that maybe, you know, the hunters are going to end up shooting each other and just making things worse. And by a stroke of luck, this local farmer named Luther Davis, he manages to catch a bobcat, or what was it, a bobcat or mountain lion? I'm trying to find it in my notes. It was basically just a regular predatory cat, it was a bobcat. So he caught it in a trap on the 13th, and he killed it. And the mayor basically took it, he strung it up on the town flagpole, and he put a sign on it that said, "This is the beast of Bladenboro," even though everybody knew it couldn't be because it was a tiny little mountain lion. It really didn't seem like the ferocious creature that everyone had been describing. And only a few days later, there were some more killings, which more or less proved it wasn't that bobcat. You know, and the real killer was still on the loose. Let's see. So the sightings, they died down for quite a while. Basically, after winter was done with, Bladenboro was pretty much free of the monster. But I did find something new I hadn't seen anybody else have published before. There was a newspaper columnist who had went to watch a sports game of some kind in a neighboring town, and as he was driving between Bladenboro and Elizabethtown, he said that he saw the Bladenboro beast. So again, not very many people quote from this article, but Carter wrote, "We came back through Elizabethtown and headed toward Bladenboro about 11:30 or a quarter to 12. About 2 miles off of Elizabethtown, a huge cat-like animal pounced out of the woods in the right some 100 feet in front of the car, made 2 huge leaps, and completely crossed the highway directly in front of us. The animal was no bobcat. It had a long tail that appeared to be about half the length of the car itself." That's pretty long. "It was about 20 to 24 inches in height, and I would guess from the rapid appearance that it weighed something like 50 pounds. It was a tan-colored creature. Everyone in the car got a good look at the animal. We make no claims that it was the long-lost beast of Bladenboro, but we are sure of one thing. We haven't seen a creature like it before, and we aren't hankering to come face-to-face with it without the benefit of an automobile's protection." So again, that's May of 1954. In December of 1954, and Robson, that's right, isn't it, Johnny? You said Robson, right?
Yeah,
not
correct,
Robson. Okay, so in Robson, in December of 1954, basically a year after the media frenzy started, there was another farmer who, he had, I'm just going to read a portion of the article. It says, "A mysterious animal struck last night within shouting distance of Robson Memorial Hospital, killing 5 medium-sized pigs and 3 chickens on a Mr. Big's tenant farm." And then, let's see, there was another killing not too long after that where a predator actually climbed a tree to get some chickens that were roosting up in a tree, and it killed them. And then about a day later, they killed a stray dog. And again, it was kind of like the situation with the bobcat before. They claimed, well, this stray dog, it's the one that killed the hogs and the chickens and all that. Well, the smart people all pointed out that the dog wouldn't climb a tree to get the chickens because the chickens were killed up in the tree. So, you know, it really had to have been, you know, some sort of feline-type predator. And then the footprints of the dog didn't match the footprints that they found on the farm. So, I mean, it was just kind of another case of the city government taking an opportunity to just say that the predator was dead when it wasn't. And then the final nail in the coffin of that story was on December 17th. They had another sighting of a strange, it wasn't even necessarily totally cat-like this time. This is a really strange one, and this is the last true sighting of the Blattenborough Beast. So again, December 17th, it was sighted at the Panthers Ford Elementary Schoolyard. Says the animal was first spotted by a group of youngsters during a chapel program, and according to the teacher, at least 25 of the kids ran outdoors to see what it was. Panthersford is a black elementary school located between Lumberton and Red Springs on Highway 211. The school is approximately 10 miles from the site of the recent mutilation of 5 young hogs on a farm near Lumberton by what is thought to have been a big dog. The teacher said she was first attracted to the animal's presence in the schoolyard by student Beulah Mae Sanders' yell, "Look, a monkey." There was an immediate scramble by the students to get a closer look. The time was approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon, according to Miss McMillan. When the school's janitor, Clifton Williams, saw the commotion and spied the animal, he picked up an axe. It would run when they ran, he explained, but when they stopped running, it stopped also. The principal said he understood the janitor got close enough to the strange beast to swing the axe, but the animal dodged the blow and ran off. Miss McMillan said she saw the animal plainly at a distance of about 50 feet, and this is the really interesting part. This is her exact quote. She says, "It looked like just a big monkey and a dog. I don't know which. It didn't run. It loped." She said the animal appeared to be colored, quote, "a dark reddish brown," end quote. It was about 3 feet high and had an extremely long tail. And don't forget the other sighting from the newspaper columnist. He also gave it an extremely long tail, so that's interesting. The superintendent said he went outside to examine the animal's tracks and found them unlike any he had ever seen. Quote, "but they definitely were not dog tracks," he exclaimed. He added, "and I certainly know what a dog track looks like." The children, said Williams, differed on a concrete description of the animal, but agreed it wasn't a dog. Some said it was a monkey. A beast scare in Robson began Tuesday with the strange death of 5 medium-sized hogs. Well, we already know all that. I'll skip that part. But the report of the monkey-like animal is reminiscent of the recent Beast of Blattenborough scare, which produced many varied and weird reports of strange beasts roaming the countryside seeking prey. And that's about it, but it's just so strange. There's not very many animals, real animals, that you can think of that you would describe as looking like a cross between a monkey and a dog.
Unless they were shape-shifting between one and the other.
Yes, that's me and John's theory, is like, what if, you know, they say it looked like a monkey, but really that was a human face and like its animal transition. And so a monkey was just the closest thing they could kind of liken that to.
Right. Well, now I've got something that has come up from some interviews that we did about 2 months ago with some folks from near Land Between the Lakes, and especially Elijah Henderson was on there. And it seems as though there was a beast that sounded like that had the screams of a woman. A man went out to check on it, and that beast circled back and killed his entire family and got out of there. But he saw the beast. He said it was unlike anything he'd ever seen. And that was right around 1950. So I'll go back and check those podcasts. We did a series of three of them on Thursday evening, and that might be a third account of a creature like the Blattenborough Beast. So I will check that out, and I'll see about interviewing Elijah Henderson, because this thing came about in Montgomery County, Tennessee, just north of Nashville. So that might be a third one, and, you know, it's in the southeast. So we'll have to see and corroborate the dates and everything. So anyway, now, I guess the more you know about local stories, the more chances there are of having corroborative evidence. So now, with all this new information that we've got, Dr. Trey Donaway, do you have a question or a comment for John LeMay on this exciting topic?
No, but it sounds like you're skipping from one find to another. So it sounds like you're building up some momentum on your search.
Well, it really
does. Absolutely.
Because we got that stuff in Mexico. And John, do you mind just re-explaining that a little bit? Because that was very interesting as well.
Yeah, the thing down in Mexico isn't just folklore. There's a region called Tlaxcala, which had hundreds of death certificates where it would say that babies died from being sucked by the witch. That's how they described it. And so basically the Mexican government actually intervened and sent in an investigation into this whole thing to see what was the cause of all of these death certificates. And so it was for sure a real thing in rural Mexico in the mid-1950s, around basically exactly the same time that the Bladenborough thing was going on. Because those Telepuchi, the vampire witches, they said like to strike on cold winter nights, you know, and the Bladenborough beast was also roaming about in the wintertime. And these vampire witches were also shapeshifters, and they would sometimes turn into big feline cats, or they might turn into, I think their most popular form was like a turkey, believe it or not. But, you know, John and I just think it's funny that, or not funny, but just interesting that, you know, you have all of these different shapeshifter stories in the mid-1950s.
Yes, you do. And now that I have realized that we have some from Montgomery County in Tennessee, I mean, this is like, it's almost like there is an epidemic of creatures in and around the United States. And I would bet, I'll make you a bet, John, I'll bet you a dollar, that if I call up Lyle Blackburn, who lives in Texas, Lyle Blackburn will be able to give us a story or two about the same type of creature in Texas, Missouri, and or Arkansas. I'll bet you money he can, because he knows, you know, that's really his stomping grounds. Like mine is the Carolinas, and yours is over there in New Mexico, Arizona, and Mexico, and his is, you know, kind of in that area of Texas and Arkansas. So I'll bet you he will come up with some too. And I mean, this is amazing. It'll be interesting if we can find a serious pattern of incidences like this in the late 40s and early 50s. So now I've got that now down on my pad, and I'll make sure that that happens before the week is out. I'll give him a call. All right, Trey, well, thank you. And Devin, do you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I was just thinking this reminds me kind of the Chupacabra, which is a legendary, you know, cryptid creature that's been sighted in California and Mexico, different parts of the Americas, but even as far up here as Northern California. And, you know, some people describe that as kind of dog-like, but also sort of like a combination of a reptile and a dog. So that could be that could probably be a shapeshifter too, and that could be a similar creature to the beast of the beast of Bladenborough that you're talking about.
Well, that's a good thought. Yeah, John, we need to do a chapter on there that just compares it to the Chupacabra. That's true.
Yeah, because especially the part about it attacking other, you know, other animals, because Chupacabra is known to, you know, attack animals, especially livestock and goats, and then drink the blood. And then I think you mentioned something about vampires, but they're said to have like they can basically stare at a creature and they can kind of paralyze it, which is usually associated with vampires.
Good point.
I love having my list here, and my list is growing longer and longer as this episode of ScaryCast keeps going. That's great. Well, Devin, thank you. That's a wonderful observation, and we will see if we can find. I will go back. I did believe it or not, I did a podcast for about 2 months on the Chupacabra. And my co-host got kind of tired of it, and I hate that he did. And he had a number of stories, so I'm going to give him a call. He's from Los Angeles, and I'll see if he remembers any stories about the Chupacabra from out there, especially from the early 50s. So now we're linking California to the Southwest, maybe to Texas, Tennessee, and on over to South Carolina. So it looks like, or North Carolina, it looks like we might have a serious pattern going here, and just a little bit of good discussion brought this about. So that's great. Now, Kyler Smith, do you have a comment or question?
I thought I did. It's kind of hard to listen and think about what I want to ask at the same time, because I'm taking all this in just like a little kid at Christmas, like, holy crap, I can't believe this is happening. But for some reason, I can't really – it doesn't make sense to me why, if something is a shapeshifter from a human to an animal, why it would be taking – or why it would be attacking other animals.
Now, I'll be dumb, and I'll say for food. Just dumb guy here. But, you know, who knows? I mean, we'll – you know, we can't ask it. If Robin were here, maybe she should – maybe she could mind speak to it. In fact, I'll ask her if she would like to do that on our show next. I hope she feels better. But, you know, we'll have to see. And that's a good point. I mean, what did the thing feed off of? What did it ultimately look like? And what are the reports of what it looked like, I guess, as we parade through Los Angeles and the Bajas, through the Southwest, over to Tennessee. And also, I will check. I've got some friends in Alabama, and I'll see what they know. I think there are some stories of the Alabama white thing, which is a monster in Alabama, and I'll write that down. I'll put a question mark by that, and I'll see how that fits in. So, again, great discussion. I'm sorry as I write that.
See, John, that gave me an idea, too, because it made me think, I wonder what if, you know, skinwalkers typically, when they attack livestock, it's just to do harm to a certain family or person, you know, like a vendetta. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could find, like, a commonality that all of the Bladenboro Beast victims had when they, you know, when they had their livestock attack? Like, what if they all had, like, a common thread amongst them? You know, like, then maybe that would explain why their animals got attacked.
Right. I think as we look at all of the attacks that have gone on, and again, you know, when you talk about skinwalkers, now you're reaching up to Utah, and if you want to go to the most famous place where the skinwalkers are. And so now you've covered about half the United States, if we can pinpoint the same type of story during the same range of years. So we'll see what, I mean, it gives us, it kind of, I'd say basically this evening has given us some direction on some potentially explosive things. And I mean, as we look at shapeshifters, and that's one thing that I told you that I wanted to do an article or a chapter on just shapeshifters, because along with the skinwalkers, which are supposed to be Navajo witches, you know, we've got other things such as the werewolf, okay? The werewolf is something that seems to be around almost every culture throughout the world. And then if you look at Trinidad and Tobago, that's where you have the Loup Garou, which is definitely a werewolf, and you see that creature in, well, of all things, here we go, in Louisiana. And we were discussing that when we were talking about Land Between the Lakes on that special series of podcasts. So again, that's another thing to look at and see if we could find some tales from approximately that time period. So I guess, if we do, all we got is Florida, and then if we can somehow find some in Florida, then we've got the entire southern part of the United States covered from the Carolinas all the way to California with these strange shape-shifting creatures. So I think that's a lot of ground to cover, but a lot of great areas of research and history, because I guess, John, what we could say is we are really historians on the unusual. Would you say that's the case?
Absolutely, and I forgot to bring up a really important thing which excited me and was partly why I wanted to jump in on the book with you. Is years ago when I was compiling a book about Ice Age kind of type creatures that survived into the modern era, I found a story about something that they called the Kentucky Dog Eater. And it was seen between 1885 up until about 1892. And again, you know, it mostly terrorized Kentucky, but it also went to Tennessee. And it was basically exactly like the Bladenboro Beast. Just it never reached that level of fame. And how it was similar is it would always go after dogs, which is mostly what the Bladenboro Beast did. You know, out of just about all the different animal types it could go after, for some reason it usually chose dogs, which is kind of unusual. And the that's where the Kentucky Dog Eater got its name. It attacked dogs. Just like the Bladenboro Beast, the descriptions of it would always vary, and also it would occasionally drain the blood, kind of like a vampire. So it's interesting, you know, again, it's kind of in the eastern portion of the United States. It shares all those traits, so it's an interesting precursor to the Bladenboro Beast for sure.
All right, now I've got a question. Were there any descriptions of this Kentucky Dog Eater?
Yes, and they were basically the same as the Bladenboro Beast, because, you know, Bladenboro, some days they'd be like, well, it's a dog, and some days they'd be like, oh, it's a big predatory cat.
Okay. Interesting. So you would say that a description of 7 feet tall, 800 pounds, might not be an appropriate description, or might it possibly
no.
be?
No, I think it was always just like the Bladenboro Beast, you know, just a quadruped predator, you know, either dog-like or cat-like. People just almost couldn't make up their mind what it looked like.
The reason I was asking is what I just described at 800 pounds and 6 to 7 feet is the Kentucky Dogman, which we've got an artist's picture of on our latest book, Look Up in the Sky, Aliens, UFOs, and Anomalies, third edition. And that's kind of a cool thing, because that is the only picture that I know of where a good artist has done a rendering of a description from a story. And the fella, you know, I think Evan Reihard is the only person that I know that actually saw a dog man and lived to tell about it. And maybe there's one other, but I think he's the only one. And I think it's amazing that he did. It's amazing. I just found him on the internet. I mean, I found him on Facebook. He said he was interested in the paranormal and he was from Kentucky. I said, you ever seen the dog man? He said, and his answer was, oh my God, yes. I said, let me friend you. I got to talk to you. So just got lucky as all get out to find him. But then, Kyler, you do say sometimes that I am the luckiest man alive, right?
I say that all the time.
Okay, well, that's how our one picture of the Kentucky Dog Man came about, was that in all the millions of people on Facebook, I found the one guy that actually saw him. So he didn't think it was that big of a deal until he finished the story, and I said, yes, that's a gigantic deal. You're the only person I know that has ever lived to tell what the dog man looked like. So it's very interesting. And so we've got a lot of great things that we've discussed tonight. And I think we can, this show has probably helped us, John. You might agree.
It's been a brainstorming session. Yeah.
Right, and it's put a lot of framework around what we're trying to do, and I had no idea that's what it would be. But anyway, I mean, I want to thank you, first of all, for this, for going into this, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to go back around to our panelists, and we'll go in reverse order. Kyler, do you have any questions, comments, or thoughts about shapeshifters, the Bladenboro monster, and monsters out in the woods that scream like women?
Well, before we got on, I mentioned that I was looking at shapeshifting and shapeshifters videos and, you know, whatever's coming up as reports. And one, I want to know if any of you guys have either seen anything yourselves or know of any stories in your states that have become popular, because all I've been seeing is like videos of maybe celebrities or just people that were accidentally caught on camera with their pupils changing from our usual circle to slits in their eyes. And that can easily be manipulated in videos. So I'm obviously just taking it as, you know, well, it could be real, it could not be real. But, you know, as professionals, I'm sure you guys know more of this about this than I do. So I wanted to ask you guys that.
Oh, Kyler, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because, like, whenever I see people make a big deal out of the, like, the shapeshifters or whatever, I'm just always like, you know, I think that's just our digital cable signal messing up for 2 seconds. You know, because, like, I feel like if that happened a lot with celebrities, maybe you would find it more often on the old film stock, you know, like old film stock or videotape for the news or for the Johnny Carson show or whatever. You know, I really feel like, in those cases, it's just our digital film, like, having its glitch. And I don't really buy into those ones. You know, I mean, I believe in shapeshifters, but a lot of those, like, ones that people post about Laura Ingraham or Biden or whoever is shapeshifting, I don't really tend to believe those, just because I just think it's our digital cameras screwing up and glitching for a second.
Okay. So then, with that being said, I ran into a couple of stories that people have ranted on about for just on some forums. And something that I saw pop up more than once was collapsing bodies and then having them just randomly get up and run. But the bodies that would collapse would almost either turn into something else, but while the body was staying there, or I don't even know how to explain it. It was the way they were explaining it. They were almost confused what happened. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
No, I heard of a video one time about Hillary Clinton getting like folded up and put in a suitcase or something, like she was a robot. That's like the closest thing I've ever heard of a collapsing human, but no, I haven't really heard of that type of what you were talking about.
Okay, I was just curious.
Well, Kyler, definitely, if you could send me a link, I would like to take a look at that, and I'll report to John what we got, okay?
Yeah, no problem.
The collapsing human. Sometimes I feel like I'm ready to collapse. That may be after I've driven 4 hours to a mini-con in Jacksonville and come back and felt like I was going to collapse all day the next day, but it was fun. It really was. Anyway, Kyler, thank you very much for those observations. Our man from California, Devin Tate, what do you have?
Hey, so this might be not the smartest question, because I don't know a lot about shapeshifters, but I was just wondering, like, in general, do shapeshifters, are they able to, like, you know, theoretically shift into any type of, you know, form that they want? Or do they tend to have, like, you know, a couple of certain, you know, like from human to a particular type of animal, like a dog? Is it something they can learn to shapeshift into other, you know, forms? Or how does that work usually?
All I know with most of the skinwalkers and the old European werewolf stories is that they have to, like,
put on the animal pelt for the animal they want to transform into. So now when you talk about people that transform into other people, that's a tough one. I don't know how they would do that or what the, like what the ritual is or whatever. But yeah, but with the old stuff though, it's just like a witch wearing an animal pelt, and I guess it kind of helps them transform, and that's all I know.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm gonna weigh in and say, I think if they can transform into one thing, they can transform into many things. But that's just a guess based on some things that I've read. It's all what you would call a very inexact science, but just trying to put pieces together, because hopefully in 200 years we'll know exactly what shapeshifters are. And right now we're just kind of like probing into the dark. But, you know, it's interesting, and it's worth talking about. And when we get more ideas like we've gotten tonight that can go into a book, I mean, who knows where this thing is going to lead? And I'm serious. I think, in my opinion, this is the real research, because this is not NSF, National Science Foundation, funded research. But we are researching topics of interest to the populace, and we're just trying to figure out what's out there. And maybe this book that John and I are going to write in 10 years, a couple of university professors might have some ideas, and John, we will be more than a footnote in the research, in their research with our book. So, I mean, who knows? And I'm going to certainly give credit to all the Scarycasters tonight for all their ideas and all that. And now, Dr. Trey Donaway, you're going to have the last word from Scarycast on tonight's subject. So what is your word?
Well, my word is something I wanted to ask John LeMay. And this week on Wednesday, the Navy, U.S. Navy, said all UFO videos are classified, and releasing them will harm national security. So basically the Navy has said it has more UFO videos, but it doesn't want to share them. And now that's a little change of pace from earlier, when it seemed like the government was a little more open about sharing information about UFOs. The big long-awaited report came out, and we got a nothing burger from that. But this is the denial to share information now as a potential harm for national security. What are you thinking, John? What do you think that's, what implications do you think that might have?
You know, Trey, I was thinking earlier during the show, just, you know, how your mind drifts. I was thinking to myself, over the past 2 years, you know, since the pandemic started and just all the weird stuff, we as the world have gotten desensitized to insanity. We've had, what is it now, 2.5 years of nothing but insane stuff, 24/7. You know, stuff that we would discuss for like decades and decades, we don't even get a chance to take a breath because we're on to the next insane thing. You know, insane things like this don't just keep happening and happening and happening. You know, something is kind of going on behind the scenes, obviously. So as to why they've suddenly changed their tune in terms of UFOs, whatever this power struggle is that's going on behind the scenes that we don't really know what it is, I'm guessing at one point they wanted to use UFOs for something. You know, they had an angle on it. Maybe things have changed. We don't know what. And now they're pulling back again for whatever reason. You know, it's kind of like there are people out there that say the Queen has been dead for months, you know, and they're just now announcing it because now is a good time for whatever reason. So who knows why they're going back on their word, but I'm sure there's some weird reason behind the scenes that we're just not privy to, being, you know, the little people.
I think it's just odd that forever, UFOs don't exist. UFOs don't exist. UFOs don't exist. And then all of a sudden, no, there are UFOs, but we're going to call it by a different name. And now we're going to be more transparent, you know, open. We're going to discuss this. We're going to have a congressional hearing on it. And now the door slams again. But they just said that it would pose a national security threat. It's just kind of, like you said, it's more bizarreness, more weirdness in our world.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to bring that up. It's a little topic, but I've been wanting to ask you what you think about the UFO flip-flopping. To me, if there's not something really there, there wouldn't be all this flip-flopping.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Pretty poor logic to me. It's hard to disprove or prove something that you don't know is or is not. But when people start slamming the door on you, unless China or Russia, and frankly, with what's going on in Ukraine, I don't think the Russians have developed any super duper secret things that are floating around in the skies in the United States. Maybe the Chinese, who knows? But I just think it's an interesting turn of events we've had just this week.
For sure.
Sure. And somebody brought up another very interesting story about there's a possibility that the Queen might have been dead for months. Who said that?
Yeah, that was me.
You know, here's my question, and I think it's the most obvious question in the world. Why did the Queen choose to die in Balmoral, Scotland? In Castle Balmoral. Why did she pick Scotland? That doesn't make a bit of sense.
Hmm.
Dr. Trey,
yeah.
Trey, you probably know as much about the royal family as anybody that I would know, because you've got a lot of experience with news and everything. Can you figure out why she would want to go to Scotland to die?
Well, I mean, it was Balmoral. And I think that's probably her home. She feels at home there as much as she would anywhere else. It's always been a great place for her family. And I think she just chose to be there. She was having mobility problems before her death. And I don't think she really wanted to be in the public eye. And she was still able to conduct the business of state from there. So I don't look at that as unusual. That's, she spent a lot of time there throughout her life, and I just think for her, that was probably maybe more home than even Buckingham Palace. Who knows?
Okay, that's interesting, and I love the way you pronounced it. Those of us in the golf world call it Balmoral. That's what it's always called, because we've got a country club over here in New England called Balmoral Country Club, and we have so many of them named for those castles over in England. That's great. Well, now you know you're definitely more of a European dude, and but thank you for that. That's good food for thought. But I don't know. I'm supposed to be this week. I'm supposed to be on Little Town Big Talk, Banana Jack and Marshall Diddle's talk show, talking about conspiracy theories and the Queen. And Pizzagate, and all kinds of crazy stuff. So Banana Jack promised me that he would record that, and we'll put that one on Scarycast. I can't wait to see what I'm going to come up with by Friday, but it's my job to come up with something that is complimentary to Scarycast. So I'll be sure to let everybody know, and we'll post it on Scarycast for people to listen to. Who knows what I'll come up with, but I'll do my best. And I got to say, this has been a wonderful, wonderful evening. We've had a great show. We've had great guests. We've had great co-hosts, had great talk. So at this moment right now, I cannot remember who's on my pad to be here next week. We got a great guest next week, and we're going to have a good time every week on Scarycast. Hopefully Robin McRae will be with us. She was definitely under the weather, and I hope she feels better. So I want to thank Dr. Trey Dunaway. I want to thank Devin Tate. I want to thank Kyler Smith. And most of all, our featured guest, John LeMay, for being on here and talking about the Bladenboro Beast, the potential of the Chupacabra being part of this, and throughout the country. So we will do continued research. And we'll probably have another brainstorming session before we finish the book. And then when we finish the book, John, you and I will come on and we'll give a full report to everybody. How does that sound?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, look, thanks a lot, everybody. It's been a pleasure. I'll be doing the call around to say thank you to all the hosts, and we appreciate every one of you. So from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, I mean, what more can you say? The sun and fun capital of the world. It is humid. It is not like, now I'm going to tell you, it is not like Lake Mead, but it is humid and really kind of beautiful. It's about 80 degrees and wouldn't be anywhere else. So thanks a lot. Good night from Myrtle Beach. And this is Dr. John Stamey saying we'll see you next week on the one, the only, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Scarycast. Take care, everybody. Say goodbye.